Next.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Counting cards is not against the law. In fact, if you're a serious bridge player, counting cards is the law. If you don't know what's been played, you're dead. Now, the deal is a bit different in the multi-million dollar world of high-stakes casino blackjack. Once again, counting cards is not, strictly speaking, illegal, but any organized effort to beat the house is a sure way to make a number of enemies very quickly. That's why a group of whip-smart MIT geeks decided they'd be better off working in teams, taking roles as spotters, gorillas, and rich Asian brats, all out to foil the casino system for spotting the smart ones. Now, through the 1990s, one of these teams took routine weekend trips to Vegas and Atlantic City, making millions, pitting their genius against the house in a game of chance. Well, not really chance, blackjack. That is, until the casinos caught on to their elaborate scheme and began to close the door on the card-counting co-eds. Connection listeners, nobody gambles to lose. Everybody wants to find a way to beat the odds. But does it take a genius to beat the dealer? What stakes are you willing to risk to stack the deck in your favor? How far can you go? Is there any honor in cards, in gambling? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. 1-800-423-TALK. My guest today is Ben Mezrich. He's a writer. His latest book is his first nonfiction. It's his investigation, his time inside the MIT blackjack team. It's called Bringing Down the House, the inside story of six MIT students who took Vegas for millions. These guys weren't exactly sanctioned by the school, the MIT team.
No, not sanctioned by MIT.
Ben, you talk about Vegas as a place that has 30 million visitors a year. The average drop for a mark is about $300.
Right, $300 to $500 on a weekend.
Wow, it's billions of dollars
if you do that. It's a lot of money. They take in a lot of money.
And at some point in the story, I get a sense that even you sort of lose track of the real value of the money. You know, what begins as $10,000 to you at the end is just like a bundle of Benjamins.
Well, when you watch these guys play, it does, the sort of sense of money sort of blurs and turns gray, because they go from betting $500 a hand to $10,000 a hand. They carry around hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, they don't make a trip without, when the team was playing, they needed $1-2 million stake just to play. So these large amounts of money, and they turn them into chips, of course, in the casino, so you really lose track of how much money you're really talking about.
You did this as well, sweating your way through a Logan airport
check. Right, I
put
some money. Well, the way they would carry their money was they would actually strap the money to their body and go through the airport. This was pre-9/11, because it's a lot more difficult now, though people still try and do it. But they would carry the money on them to bring it into Vegas, so that no one would know, you know, how much money they were moving in and out, and also so they'd have their whole stake with them and can move fluidly from casino to casino. So I wanted to sort of get a sense of what it was like to be with the team and sort of feel what they were feeling. So, yeah.
So how did you get into this? You had one of the players,
right,
who was your in, is that right?
Well, Kevin Lewis, who is the star of the book, was a friend of mine socially. I was at Harvard and he was at MIT. He's a little bit older, but after school we sort of knew each other socially, and I didn't know about his double life. I knew he always had plenty of money and he went to Las Vegas a lot, but I didn't really know that, you know, he was a regular MIT kid. And then he basically invited me in. He brought me to Las Vegas, and there's sort of a transformation. They're treated like rock stars out there. I mean, there's limos and huge suites. And like, they play, whoever played the big player, which is the guy with the big money, would get these incredible comps. That's the way the casinos work, is they give you lots of freebies to keep you coming back. So essentially, out in Vegas, these guys are rock stars, and here they're normal people. And I realized there was something going on, and then he began to tell me the story of the team. And that's when I realized this was a really big operation to make a great thriller.
In fact, the story of the team goes back, at least 20 years,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, a couple decades or more. Card counting itself began in the late 60s with Edward Thorpe's Beat the Dealer.
This is the UC Berkeley math,
yeah,
prof.
And also MIT visiting professor.
Right.
But the MIT team is a couple decades old. This incarnation was in the 90s that I wrote about, but the team itself has been going on for a while.
And this was only one of who knows how many?
Well, at this particular time, there was definitely more than one team, and one part of the book is their discovery that there are other teams competing for the same casino ground. But this team was a split off of another team, and then this team itself split off. And what happens is, as the team starts to earn a lot of money, it wants to invest its own money rather than using investors' money. And so they want to go off independently so they can make more and more money.
And in a nutshell, what were they doing?
Well, essentially what they were doing, the basis for card counting is that blackjack is beatable because blackjack has a memory. Every hand that occurs in blackjack affects the next hand, the next hand, the next hand, because certain cards are no longer in the deck. If you can keep track of the high cards and know when there are more high cards still left to be played, you have an advantage. Because when there are more high cards left to play, the dealer will bust, meaning get over 21 more often and lose, or you'll get blackjack more often.
But I thought the casinos figured this out and then started stacking six decks in one shoe,
right?
So you couldn't do that.
No, well, six decks, definitely, it changes it around, but it doesn't actually make it impossible or even more difficult to card count, because the key is you don't have to remember every card. You have to remember ratios of high to low cards, how many high are left. And what you do is you keep track of this, and you use, you know, some level of math. It's not that high math, but you have to use fairly good math to sort of figure out when your advantage changes, when it's time to raise your bet, and that's how you take advantage of it. The problem with card counting is when you raise and lower your bet, the casino can see you doing this, and they'll kick you out. So what the MIT...
I'd raise and lower my bet at any point in any card game. No?
You can, but if you start raising your bet like from $10 to $500 to $1,000 when the count's good and you're winning a lot, you'll get thrown out. That's essentially what'll happen. So what these guys did was it created a division of labor that would spread 10 kids or 6 to 10 kids across a blackjack field, a playing arena, put one person at each table. That person is playing the minimum, counting the cards, but never raising his bet. When the count gets good, he signals in the guy called the big player or the gorilla player. That player, who acts like a rich drunk kid, slides into the table, bets like $10,000 a hand. He doesn't change his bet, but he bets the high. When the cards no longer are good, he gets the signal, he gets up and leaves. So from the casino's point of view, there's a bunch of people playing low hands but never really raising or lowering their bet. There's some rich kid running around always betting a ton of money but never raising
and making
or
a fair
bet,
amount of money.
Right? But they, for them, unless they can figure out the relationships between these people, it's very hard to throw these people out.
And Kevin Lewis got into this because he was one of the smart kids at MIT.
He's a very smart kid, mechanical engineering major at MIT. It's also one of these things where trust is a big part of it, because you're dealing with large amounts of money. So they would hand pick people for each, you know, new team. And the other thing is you had to have a certain look. Certain types of people do not stand out in a casino environment. And usually Asian non-white people with large amount of money do not stand out. A white kid, 23 years old, with $5 million on him stands out in a casino. But an Asian kid with $5 million doesn't stand out. And that's just, it's both cultural and also just the way, you know, Vegas looks. If you go to a high roller table, you'll see Asian kids, Persian kids, and celebrities, basically. And so these guys had a certain look. They had a certain ability. You had to have a certain bravado, I guess. You had to be a very strong personality to be able to pull it off, because there's a lot of acting involved, too. At some point, they used Hollywood makeup artists to do their makeup. They would use disguises, because over time, the casinos started to figure them out and come after them.
Now, we have Kevin Lewis on the line with us. Hi, Kevin.
How are you doing?
Good. Kevin's been listening in. Now, Kevin's not your real name, is it?
No, it's not.
What is your real name?
I don't know. It's been so long that everyone's been calling me Kevin that I think I've forgotten my real name.
Nothing, if I understand this right, Kevin, nothing that you did was illegal.
That's correct.
Moving hundreds of thousands of dollars through the airport may be suspect, but it's not illegal.
Correct.
Counting cards may be suspect and may have you banned at casinos right across the country, but it's not illegal.
Correct.
You paid at least some taxes.
Yes.
So why do you have to then go around in the witness protection program?
For me, it's not necessarily the witness protection program. It's not that I'm embarrassed or anything like that of anything I did. However, for me, I just like to have my own life and keep my own life, and I potentially would like to not be known, or, you know, I don't want to have my whole life be known as you know, the guy that took Vegas for millions. I have a lot of stuff going on in my life besides that, and am happy with it. So I'd rather, for as long as I can, keep, you know, some level of anonymity.
Now, you and the team made that great pile of money, but then the team eventually broke apart. Someone squealed on you?
It wasn't the breaking apart part wasn't squealing. The situation that happened, and this is detailed in the book, is basically happened to do with, I would say, with greed more than anything. When you're dealing with a lot of money like that, people can cast friendships aside, which was essentially what happened. Everyone in the group that I was involved with were very good friends. In fact, the two people that brought me in were two of my best friends. And then as time went on, what happens is that the people that have played for a long time become extinct, or as we call them, dinosaurs. They are no longer allowed to play at certain casinos, and in some ways really have no more use to the group. There were a couple of them that had become dinosaurs and felt like their time was drawing to a close. So rather than allow that to happen to themselves, they sort of splintered off and tried to form their own group of followers that they could train, and then their use in the group would be their money and their training abilities.
How did they mark you originally, Kevin? How did the people who were already doing this say, hey, we want to bring you in?
You know, I think that it was a matter of there were a couple friends of mine, sort of they'd maybe had their eye on me for a while, and that I was a smart kid who understood numbers very well. I've worked in the trading on the floor of the Chicago Board of Options Exchange, and you know, they knew that I was someone that would be good with numbers, and plus I'm Asian, so I think that for them, they knew. I mean, I think that for a long time we thought, and I think we thought correctly, that Asian people just do not. Asian people betting a lot of money in a casino just do not stand out. They could be from Hong Kong or, you know, from Singapore, or just rich kids coming over here from, you know, for school that just have some extra money from their parents.
Yeah, well, where did the money come from, though, Kevin? Where did the money, the seed money come from?
The seed money originally came from, you know, from these investors, and in the book they're called these shadowy investors. They were mostly people that had made their money through blackjack originally and were sort of what we call dinosaurs. They couldn't play anymore, so what they did instead was they invested their money in, you know, blackjack teams and trained kids to play blackjack and sent them out to play blackjack in Las Vegas.
And so it didn't really matter to you where the money came from or that you had to give a bunch of it back to the people who had originally put the stake up. In a way, you were just working for a small cut, right?
Yeah, it didn't matter. Yeah, I would say it mattered in the way that I felt confident that they weren't, you know, that this wasn't drug money or anything like that.
How did you know?
Because I knew the people that were invested, kind of, and I, you know, I knew where they came from. They weren't, you know, you're not dealing with, you know, mafia members here. You're dealing with people that went to MIT, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 15 years ago, and just had extra money from gambling that they wanted to keep, you know, cycling through the system.
How much you got in your bedroom closet right now, Kevin?
I don't have anything in my bedroom closet anymore. I have invested most of it wisely in different things, and you know, most of it's put away now. When you have what happened to a team member of mine, which was his apartment got broken into and a bunch of our money got stolen, it could have been, ended up being not that much in the grand scheme of things, but could have been in the, you know, hundreds of thousands of range. You kind of get wary of keeping money in your apartment like that.
We'll pick it up when we come back. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me in the studio, Ben Mezrich, author of Bringing Down the House, the inside story of 6 MIT students who took Vegas for millions. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Now, most people first saw card counting glorified on the big screen in the 1988 film Rain Man. Remember Tom Cruise as Charlie Babbitt deciding to exploit the mathematical abilities of his autistic savant brother played by Dustin Hoffman? And so he takes him to Vegas to beat the house.
You want to hit?
No, you don't want to hit where you've got 18.
You want to hit.
So you have 18.
You don't want to hit. He doesn't want to hit. Hit
Definitely
me.
Want to hit.
Hitting 18.
He doesn't want to hit.
Hit me.
Don't. You took my queen, Ray. I've got a 10. I needed that queen. I can't take
sir,
your queen.
Sir, please don't touch the cards.
I need my own queen, Ray.
There's lots of them.
There's lots of them?
Lots and lots of them.
Hold on here. Hold on here for a second. I'm gonna double down.
Queen. Queen.
Yes, sir. You gotta love this town.
Ah, yes, but many things that seem too good to be true don't really last that long. Their success would not elude the video surveillance, the eye in the sky.
Congratulations, Mr. Babbitt. Counting into a six-deck shoe is quite a feat.
I'm afraid I don't understand what you're talking about.
We make videotapes, Mr. Babbitt, and we analyze the tapes, and we even share some of the information with the other casinos. Now, these tapes suggest that you should take your winnings and leave the state.
Mr. Kelso, someone has a good day at the tables and you accuse them of illegal activities. Is this how you treat all your guests?
All you have to do is close your mouth and go home. And those are the best odds you're going to see for a while. I'd take them.
My next guest spent more than a decade shadowing the Charlie Babbitts and the Kevin Lewises of the world as a casino security and surveillance operator. He's now vice president of gaming services for iView Systems in Las Vegas. James Hartley is joining us from his office in that city of sin. Hi, Mr. Hartley.
Hello.
The card counting that we're talking about on the program, this is a phenomenon that is not in any way new to the casino security people, is it?
No.
How about the techniques? Are they always finding ways around you?
Yes.
And so people can always make a little bit of money until you catch up with them.
Very true. And even after we catch up to them, you can continue. There's a lot of jurisdictions now. It's not just one place.
So what was your job? How did you try and figure these people out?
Well, originally, I started out in surveillance, watching everything. And you got to remember, a lot of times, the card counters themselves love to attach an importance to themselves that we're looking at them. Surveillance spends a lot more time looking at employees for possible employee theft than just about anything else. So when these things happen, actually, watching a team and working that is a little more fun than watching a cashier. So you'll focus on it at times, and when it's really busy, the teams tend to come, and that's when you work on that.
Do you know these guys, the MIT blackjack team, Kevin Lewis?
Oh, certainly.
How do you know them? From photographs? From
yes.
Watching them play?
Both.
Are they crooks?
No.
What are they?
They're very smart guys who found an edge in a game and go out and take advantage of it.
I mean, help me understand it from the casino's point of view, because you, as soon as you catch them, you throw them out. But what they're doing is not really illegal.
It's not illegal. Generally, what the casino is doing is refusing service. They reserve the right to refuse service to anyone, just like any other business.
You can't eat in this restaurant.
Exactly.
And Kevin Lewis, you still on the line there? Kevin, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. Do you recognize this man's voice? Did he ever grab you by the collar?
And... I don't think so. Did you ever grab me by the collar?
No. I would rarely actually make contact with anyone.
I actually have had pretty good luck and pretty good relationships with casino people in that, you know, when someone tells me they don't want me to play there, that's fine with me. It's their place. I usually get out of there, you know. So yeah. I haven't had a lot of real physical run-ins per se, but, you know.
I'm not sure who Kevin is exactly. I have a pretty good idea, but nailing it exactly down is tough. Generally, for me, the majority of the time, if a guy didn't show up for 2 to 3 months after throwing him out, after 2 to 3 months and he came back, I wasn't upset, because they will come back. Some of them come back quicker than others, but...
James, when you talk about the Vegas that you're describing, is this a more buttoned-down corporate Vegas attitude? Because I would have thought that someone like Kevin Lewis might actually invite some sort of physical harm in the old-style Vegas that we read about.
It really depends on the company that's involved and who's doing it and which location you're at. They all operate differently. The old-style Vegas, again, usually you didn't have those guys involved in day-to-day operations that would, you know, physically harm someone like that. And card counters, you know, at times things have happened, but generally they're not treated in that fashion.
Ben Mezrich's in the studio with me. He's written a book about this called Bringing Down the House. And Ben, you spent time, you know, in effect, standing between these two, the men in suits that you described, the James Hartley people and Kevin Lewis at the table. And there's a kind of gamesmanship quality to the way they're describing it, but there's also a little bit more of an edge to it when you're there. Am I wrong about
that? Well, it's a cat-and-mouse game, really, and it's both high-tech and low-tech. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of private eyes and people like that who track these guys as well. And there is an undercurrent of I have run into a lot of people who really hate these kids simply because they don't like the fact that they get away with it. I've also run into people who are, you know, more tolerant of it. And card counters have been harassed and threatened and beaten up and things like that over the years. Kevin's been lucky and he's been good. And he's also, like he says, when they tell him to leave, he leaves. A lot of times what the casino personnel will do is they try and back room you. They try and bring you to a room, photograph you, trespass, which means make you sign something that says you'll never come back or else you'll be arrested. But it's really a harassment kind of thing. They sort of swarm around a card counter. They do things to make sure he knows he's not wanted and shouldn't come back. Other members of the team has actually, you know, seen guns, have seen things like that, just sort of to keep them knowing that they shouldn't be doing this anymore. But there's sort of different levels of it and different people, and it really does depend on where they try and get away with it. I think overseas it's a lot more dangerous, but Las Vegas is very corporate as well, and so there's so much money to be made that nobody really wants to screw it up by causing a real incident.
Such as James doing something on the floor that's going to attract too much attention?
Right.
Exactly.
So it's what? It's just like Ben's describing, you stand too close to him and say, Kevin, we're on to you?
Well, really, I mean, from my perspective, what Ben's saying is true. I prefer basically to kind of waste their time to cost them money, because it's all about time and motion, you know, within the business on all sides and for them as well. What a casino is looking for in a game, the card counters are looking for in a game, which is fast, accurate dealers, you know, a lot of rounds per hour. It's more money for both sides. So in essence, what you really want to do is waste their time to an extent and then get them out of there. Back rooming them oftentimes will only kind of set them against you, and they're going to come in more, and you're going to deal with it more, and then you have the possibility of a lawsuit because a security guard makes a mistake and things like that. Just, you know, it's not a money-making proposition going to court.
Our number's 1-800-423-8255 to Somerville, Massachusetts now, and someone whose name is in quotes, Bruce, is joining the program. Does that mean Bruce is not really your name?
Yeah, I'd rather not use my real name. I actually know Jim Hartley. He knows me very well, although I don't know if you'll recognize the voice. Hi there, Jim.
Hello.
Hi. I'm currently a professional blackjack player, and I've been doing this for a few years. I used to be in what was at the time a later incarnation of the MIT blackjack team, which this particular incarnation of it dissolved, and I now play for another team whose name I will not mention. But I just want to say that there's something we're talking about here that isn't quite how things always work. Jim is right in that he always treats us politely and respectfully because what we do is not illegal. But the casinos are making a lot of money out of the fact that people have believe that they can beat blackjack, and they believe that they can beat blackjack because it is true that you can do so. But it requires a very large bankroll and a lot of discipline and a lot of intelligence. So a lot of people are being exploited by the casino by this fact. The casinos then turn around, and when someone appears who can beat blackjack, they treat them like criminals. It is true that frequently they just ask you politely to leave, but I found that as I play more and more, this gets to be more the exception than the rule. And
Bruce, were you at MIT for a time?
Yes, I was.
So you guys got to help me with something, you and Kevin both.
Uh-huh.
You're at an institute of about the highest learning that exists anywhere in the land. Lord knows what your parents or you were paying for tuition, but it's
$30,000
for you to become some Nobel Prize-winning economist or scientist. And you're wearing a sharkskin suit and a gold medallion and hanging out in Vegas on the weekend.
Something like that. Yep, that's right.
Kevin?
Well, I just think it's a sort of a naive way to look at it to say, oh, well, I mean, like I said, I worked for a couple of years as a trader in the Chicago Board of Options Exchange. And what was funny,
but when you started going to Vegas?
I'm sorry?
When you started going to Vegas instead, did you tell your parents that's what you were doing on the weekends?
Yeah, I mean, I'm more or less, and again, you know, all this stuff is detailed in the book, so it's like it's...
Well, the book says that you didn't tell your parents.
Well, it took a little while for me to tell my parents, and the reason was because it took a while for me to understand what I was doing in terms of how people would perceive it.
Okay, so explain that to me. What did you figure out?
Well, the bottom line is, when I was a trader, I traded options, and I could never quantify my edge. In other words, I could never quantify what I was going to win or what I was going to make on a daily basis as well as I could in blackjack. With blackjack, the numbers were so clear. I knew when I sat down to a table in what situation, how much I would have won, you know, how much I was supposed to win statistically.
Yes.
I could never say that about what I was supposed to make as a trader. And so I said, well, this is even more sure money than trading. It's even more mathematical. It's less like gambling. The only difference is one is done in a casino and one is done on an exchange. So one is, quote-unquote, socially acceptable and the other isn't. So, I mean, it took me a while
to
come to terms.
The good point is that this isn't gambling. They don't consider themselves gamblers. They're essentially, you know, exploiting an arbitrage moment. It's no different than going to Wall Street. It's no different than using your brain in any way that's available to sort of create a system of inequity that favors you. And so when I interviewed these guys, it was really interesting to me that none of them consider themselves gamblers. And the truth is, none of them are gamblers. They don't play blackjack if they don't have an edge. They don't go there just to play. They don't go there to gamble. They go there because they have a system that works.
So what does that mean? Does that mean that because they're there as mathematicians, that ethics don't come into play, that morals don't come into
play?
Well,
I mean, the morality of what they're doing, it's and Kevin will have to admit that, you know, to some extent, he knows that people will look at it and say, okay, this, the main reason I think he didn't tell his parents for a long time is he thinks that they would think it was something wrong with it until he was able to explain to them in a way that they understood that it wasn't going and gambling and drinking and partying and making money in Vegas, the city of sin.
Though it all was, of that was part of it.
Right, but it was about math and about science and using sort of his engineering background to beat a system that is really unfair normally, but is fair only in this one case. And so, I mean, I understand the moral issue with it. I understand that people look at gambling and think it's bad. But if you really read the book or you really understand what it is they're doing, that's not what's bad about it.
Well, the immoral part of gambling tends to be, and this is you know, from a religious standpoint, the whole idea of the Puritan worth ethic and working hard for the money you make. When you gamble, you make money easily and you don't value that. But if you read the book and if you've ever seen us, and I'm sure that Bruce can attest, we work hard for our money. We put lots of time, lots of practice, and it is a hard, hard job.
Yeah, I mean, this is Bruce speaking here. A lot of the people in my current team that have this as a full-time and then some job, you know, working certainly more than 40 hours a week is doing this and making their living.
Let's hear from Jim Hartley on this, because, Jim, you're in the business of marking these people, making sure that they don't take too much of the casino's money. But when the conversation drifts into ethics and morals and gambling or not gambling, and it's just the same as playing the stock market, where do you come down on this?
I agree with them in a lot of ways. It is all the math is the same from the stock market over to gambling. It works the same. They do work very hard. It's not an easy thing to do.
So the measure would be if they're not causing any kind of material harm to someone else at the same table, or if they're not rigging the slot machine so my grandmother gets ripped off while they make a killing, then that's how you would draw the line?
As far as
whether or not something's ethical or not, you know what I mean? What you seem to be saying, or what everybody seems to be saying, is that the only thing that's being hurt here is the house.
I have something to say. This is Bruce here. If I may jump in.
Go ahead, Bruce.
I think some people that I know that have for whom this kind of leaves a bad taste in their mouth is that from our point of view we're exploiting a deception. If the casino knows we have an edge, they don't let us play, and that's very reasonable. They're not in the business of giving people money; they're in the business of taking money from people. So I am in a casino as long as the casino believes that I am going to lose money. So I deceive them into thinking that I'm a drunk or that I'm a high roller that doesn't care about his money. I shave my head, I grow a beard, I dye my hair, I wear
sunglasses. Change your name.
I wear, you know, baseball caps and whatever. Anything to make them think that I'm someone else, make them not recognize my face. And that is actually a weird part of the thing. I want to play and act for the casino so they believe that they are happy to have me there because I'm going to eventually lose my money. And that kind of leaves a bad taste in people's mouths and, you know, just the whole deceiving. I happen to think it's fun. I happen to enjoy playing the role and playing the act. It's almost like, you know, being an actor in a movie. But a lot of people think that, you know, we're making money out of being deceitful.
How about you, Kevin? What's the line? Where do you draw the line?
In terms of whether it's unethical or not, I mean, it's not...
Just a comfort line for you. Like, I won't cross that line, you know? You'll go in with a wig on, you'll put makeup on.
Well, actually, you know, it's funny because I know exactly where that line is. There was a point during our time when there were a couple of senior members of the group that were exploring the idea of doing a couple things. One was using a computer to help out and increase our edge. And the other was using some signaling devices, like localized pagers, that would allow us also to increase our productivity. And I told them I wouldn't do it. And the reason we didn't want to do it is, I mean, that was when the point changed from using my mind to actually using a device to do that. And, you know, for me, that was the line. I mean, one was clearly legally cheating, and one was clearly legally not cheating. So, I mean, the law had drawn the line for me there.
All right. Bruce, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you for having me.
And James Hartley, thanks for being with us on the program.
Thanks.
James Hartley is Vice President of Gaming Services, iView Systems in Las Vegas. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Connection listeners, join us in our conversation about the gambling habits of the MIT Blackjack team. The book is Bringing Down the House. It's written by Ben Mesrick. It's the inside story of six MIT students who took Vegas for millions. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Lexington's National Heritage Museum, presenting the national premiere of Enterprising Women, 250 years of American business through February 23rd. Details at enterprisingwomenexhibit.org. By Mississippi's of Roxbury Restaurant and Caterers, helping conference planners meet their budgets with selections from Mississippi's international menu.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. This hour, the inside story of six MIT students who took Vegas for millions. It's a book written by Ben Mesrick. It's called Bringing Down the House. He's with me in the studio and joining us on the phone, Kevin Lewis, not his real name, a former MIT Blackjack team member. Kevin, do you still play?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, just more recreational now than anything.
What does that mean? You don't play for money?
No, I don't play for big money.
What's that mean?
I don't know. Big money is tens of thousands.
So what do you play for?
Hundreds and thousands, that kind of thing.
There must be some part of the whole game, walking into a casino, that sort of gives you that Ocean's 11, Dean Martin sense of command over a place, particularly if you're walking in with the team. Do you miss that?
Yeah, I think so, but there... You know, I mean, I think that one of the reasons that I wanted to sit down with Ben and write this and get this book written was because it was one of those things, like, I wanted it down on paper to say we did this and this is what we did, and it almost put a cap to it for me. I mean, it was, you know, like any baseball player or anything like that has a career, and when their career is over, they like to, you know, look back on it, nostalgic, and kind of just remember what it was like.
So what was your World Series? What was your World Series night, if you sort of hit the peak and you now look back on it with some satisfaction?
You know, there was one year, and it's probably not just one. I guess the World Series night for me was event for me was a Super Bowl weekend I don't even remember what year it was exactly. We won, I would say, about $450,000, for the weekend. So about $500,000. And that was on about, $1 million of investment. So we made roughly, 50% return in a weekend on our money. And I can remember so well just having about $1 million, I think it was $980,000, sitting in a duffel bag between myself and a friend of mine, and we were just sitting there hanging out thinking, gosh, there's $1 million in this bag, and you know, we won half of it. And that was probably the culminating moment for me, you know, my World Series.
Right. I mean, when I started researching it and I started hanging out with them, it's really a dramatic, thrilling thing to watch. And I know Kevin's kind of jaded because he's done it so much, but when you see them spread across sort of a blackjack pit and they're signaling each other with their eyes and they all know where everybody is, it's an amazing thing that they're sort of in control of that casino, or at least there's a feeling they're in control of that casino. It's almost like a choreographed thing with the big player bouncing from table to table, playing the part perfectly. There's a lot of great scenes where, like, maybe he's sitting with the New York Knicks, players from the Knicks, and they have no idea he's just some Asian kid, but he's betting twice as much as them or three times as much as them. A lot of it had to do because the big weekends are sort of the celebrity-filled weekends. That's the best time to get away with
the
this.
Boxing then, matches.
Right, you don't show up. I mean, you're betting a lot of money, but everyone's betting. And who's going to notice you when Patrick Ewing is betting $10,000 right next to you? And so there's these great scenes where these MIT kids are sort of spread in with Howard Stern or Kevin Costner or whatever, playing more money than the stars, winning, in fact, and the other guys are losing. But it's just sort of this great, and they're signaling each other, looking at each other. They look at sort of the rest as sort of, I don't remember if you call them civilians or peasants, or is just sort of the average person who's just there to throw.
Just one thing.
Sure.
There's no professional athlete that was bent more than me.
right.
Just,
and they, you know, it's
just want to be clear about that.
I mean, it's just an amazing thing. I mean, Kevin ended up being one of the highest rollers, one of the casinos has ever had. It's that level of play that they're playing at, and so it's pretty amazing.
Let's go to Canton, New York. Dave's been hanging on the line. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I just had a comment about the guy from the Gaming Commission.
Oh, okay.
And my comment was, you know, talking about tagging the people, marking the people, and my comment was that, you know, hey, so these guys are smart, and these guys have figured out a legal way to break the system. Hey, good for them. What about, you know, and he made it sound more like, you know, oh, you know, the casino doesn't want its money stolen. I mean, maybe he didn't use those words, but what about all of the average people, as the one gentleman just put it, who go out there with gambling problems, with their money from their families that their families could put to better use, spending their money there? The casinos don't have a problem taking their money. Only when their money gets taken do they have, you know, this problem. So, hey, if these guys figured out a way to do it legally, you know, that's great.
That's a really good point, because if you want to think about the ethics of it, well, who is the most unethical person in the situation? And it's the casino. I mean, the casino, you know, they say it's about service or whatever, but they're trying to hide the fact that they're set up to beat you. If you aren't on the MIT blackjack team and you go to Las Vegas, you're going to lose. And that's the bottom line. Maybe not that one time, but over time, you're going to lose. That's how it's set up. It's an entertainment thing. You know, the glitz and the glamour, the shows and the food and all of that is fantastic. But what it's all, you know, trying to hide is that at its core, this is a system specifically set up to take your money. That's all it's about, is to take your money.
But most of the people who go through the door know that, so there's an implicit contract.
Well, you know it, but you sort of forget it. I mean, the whole idea is the chip is an amazing thing. The chip makes you forget you're playing with money. It's just a little round plastic thing you're playing with. But that plastic thing, you don't have a problem betting $10. But if I walked up to you and said, give me $10, you'd have a problem giving me $10. But it's the same thing. If you go to Vegas a lot of times, you're going to lose. You're going to lose $300 a weekend. That's the average if you bet, you know, the average amount. And so the idea that, you know, a group of kids suddenly can beat the casino and they should be kicked out and they should be harassed, there is something that seems wrong about that to me. You know, the casinos are sort of, they're trying to trick you a little bit.
Do you get it, Kevin? Do you get why they're keeping you out? Because, I mean, if they let the teams proliferate, that'd be it for the casinos, wouldn't it?
I think that they vastly overrate. Well, I mean, one thing about the guy that you had on, that James guy, is he has one of the most intelligent and mature viewpoints on card counters that I've ever heard a casino person have. I mean, he must be, you guys must have done a good job finding him, because he's knowledgeable and intelligent. Most of the casino type people that are doing this really have a horrible opinion of card counters where they do think they're cheating, mm-hmm. et cetera. For them, it's a bottom-line decision. I agree with Ben. I don't think it's a fair bottom-line decision. I mean, I think that if they really looked at their bottom line and figured out how much time they spend on preventing card counters from being able to play in their casinos, they'd find that it was probably a lot less money, a lot more money than we actually take from them in a year. I mean, if we take a great team and in our heyday, we're winning, you know, between $1 to $2 million a year, how much is that from the bottom line of a place like MGM Grand? And that $1 to $2 million is spread over, say, 20, 30 casinos. So, I mean, how much money are we really taking from them? And is there a real worry of there being, 40, 50, 60, 70 different card counting teams coming and doing that? There's no way that that would happen.
All right.
I mean, it just takes too much time and practice and trust and everything that's involved with that. There's just no way that would ever happen.
Let's move along here now. Dave, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Oshkosh, Wisconsin now, and Mark's joining us. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
I am a blackjack dealer at an Indian casino here in Green Bay, and I have a problem with what the card counters do in terms of its relationship to the average player on the table. It's evident to those of us that work in the game that there can be hot shoes for the house, hot shoes for the players. There's a definite flow to the way the cards come out, and card counters change that flow, and oftentimes what they wind up doing is stealing money from the other players on the table when they change the flow of the cards.
See, I don't quite get that, because I would have thought...
Can I address this?
Go ahead, Kevin.
Explain to me the flow from a mathematical standpoint. Explain to me what you mean by flow, because I've heard this before, and I don't understand it.
Well, that's probably because you're a mathematician, you know. I can't explain it to you mathematically. All I know is that I have 9 years of experience as a dealer on the table, and I see it all the time. The cards work the way they work. You can count them all you want, and you may win, and obviously from your presentation, you have won. But what you're doing when you take cards that wouldn't normally be taken is change the flow of the cards on the table. You're taking cards that some other players might take. You're leaving cards that other players don't want.
So they're actually stealing the good cards.
What happens is that you're cheating the other players on the table
by stealing the good cards out of the deck.
They might need or want or not want, and causing them to lose at the same time you're winning.
See, this kind of thinking is actually the reason why there are so many casinos, why Vegas has so many lights, and why the MGM Grand is the biggest hotel in the world. Because gamblers believe this way, and there is no mathematical reasoning behind what he's saying, and there is no logical reasoning behind what he's saying. The cards are in the shoe are predetermined. What does it matter whether I take 1, 2, 3, 4 cards? People believe across the board, these gamblers believe these ridiculous notions, and that's why gamblers won't play basic strategy, why gamblers won't do the statistically right thing, because they believe that there's some kind of flow to all of this. And that's why casinos should never worry about card counters, because there's plenty of other ridiculous people that believe what this dealer believes that will make money for, that will continue to give money to the casinos.
Mark?
You know, I can only speak from the experience of seeing it happen, seeing this drunk sit down at the table and bump his bets and watch when he leaves, and then a shoe that might have been hot for the table is suddenly cold.
So Mark, I guess what...
Every hand afterwards. Logic to it. There's no mathematics to it other than the fact that I've
You're talking
it
about sort of a magically... Somehow this guy is magically changing the flow of the cards. It might look like that, but it's not possible. I mean, there's no way that someone can walk in, and by the fact that he took a card, he somehow changed the sort of flow of the situation. It's hard math. This is the reason the casinos are set up. If they thought there was really a flow, they would be too frightened to do this. I mean, they know that it's all about math. Everyone involved in the casinos know that they have a mathematical advantage. The blackjack team knows that they have a mathematical advantage. They're not affecting the play. They're not going to make the guy to the left or the right lose because they're taking advantage of the situation.
Hey, when I sit down at a table, too, and I actually have even tried to help people out, meaning even some, you know, stars with a lot more, you know, a lot of money down there, I've tried to tell them, you know, you probably should hit in that case where it's a very clear situation where you want to hit in that situation. But, you know, people don't listen, and it's fine if they don't listen. It's their money. I don't have any problems with that.
But you're not giving them money to play with.
No.
Goodwill only goes so far.
Well, goodwill means I'm trying to help them out and try to help them win just as much as anyone else, you know?
Kevin, I want to thank you for being with us.
No problem.
It's been cool having you on the show.
No problem. Thank you.
Kevin Lewis, not his real name. And, Ben, there's a kind of a funny reverse that goes on here in that somebody at some point while you were writing the book let you know that it was a good thing that you were writing the book from the casino's point of view.
Right. It's interesting because a book like this popularizes the idea that blackjack is beatable, which it is. And so this brings people to Las Vegas. Vegas is not unhappy with this book. In fact, I'm doing a signing at Caesar's Palace. I'm doing a lot of promotion there. Vegas is buying the book because Vegas knows that if you make people realize that one game perhaps is beatable, this will bring people out there. Ironically enough, we just sold the movie to MGM. The movie was picked up. Kevin Spacey, the actor.
Wait, MGM runs casinos,
they own
right?
half the casinos in town. And they've picked up the movie. They're going to let us film there. They're going to, you know, there's a sort of synergy idea that they know a book like this is not bad for them. They don't like card counters, and they'll kick them out if they catch them, but they like the idea of card counting because it brings people to Las Vegas. And the thing about card counting is, if you make one mistake an hour trying to do this system, you're actually doing worse than if you didn't count at all because you're raising and lowering your bet enormously, and you're making mistakes. So they know that it's very hard to do this. I outline in my book exactly how to do this. But if you attempt it, you've got to practice for months. I mean, these guys practice 6 hours a day for months before they could take the test that allowed them to be on the team. And you have to be perfect. You can never make any mistakes. And so the problem is a lot of people read a book like this, go to Las Vegas and try it, and lose. So the key is you've got to do it right. And Vegas knows that most people aren't mathematically at the level or don't have the patience.
And can you do it?
I mean, I have tried to do it. I can play perfect basic strategy, which is, you know, I can play well, but would I be able to join this team right now? Probably not.
Can you play blackjack in a casino and make money?
I like to think so, but I don't believe so. I'm not that great, though. No.
Ben, thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me.
Ben Mezrich is the author of Bringing Down the House, the inside story of six MIT students who took Vegas $4 million. And earlier in the program, Kevin Lewis, not his real name, former MIT Blackjack team member. We also talked with Jim Hartley, vice president of gaming services, iView Systems. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Arik Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugertz. Our interns are Carter Holleran and Meredith Levinson. Graham Smith is our senior producer. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Oh, there's blackjack and poker and the roulette wheel. A fortune won and lost on every deal. All you need is a strong heart and a nerve of steel. Viva Las Vegas! Viva Las Vegas! Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.